Top of the morning to you.
Oh, yeah. I was not at all prepared for that.
The best part about that is that that's the very first time you've ever greeted anybody on a Skype call.
I think that's accurate. I really honestly...
I'm not sure that was a greeting. I guess technically you're right. It is a greeting of a kind, but not meant that way. So is your beard gone or what?
No.
This is my fear. I was like, he's going to get back and he's still going to have it. You just don't let it happen to you. Does Tiff like it?
Yeah.
Is it going to determine whether, this is a problem. It's a big problem.
I have started this morning in Ireland, the conclusion of a wonderful trip to the UL conference. So I woke up this morning in Dublin. It is now in the time zone that I was supposed to be used to, 2 in the morning. And so we'll see how this goes. I never really shifted 100% to the new time zone. So what has really happened is now just time has lost all meaning, and I'm just always tired, but yet can't sleep. So this should be interesting.
Delightful. I am overjoyed that you are this tired with respect, because this means I have a prayer of going to bed somewhere near my normal bedtime, because I figured about an hour you're going to be like, I gotta go. and then at this point, it'll be great.
No, he's punch drunk now. He's going to be all loopy. Oh, God. He's going to want to talk even longer.
Wait, we're having a holiday party? I gotta go. I'll be right back.
He's high on life. I'm gonna go through the same thing that Marco's going through, only realize I'm not gonna come back and do a podcast. I'm gonna come back and go back to work.
Yeah, that's not fun.
I mean, technically this is work for all of us, me included.
Mm-hmm. Except some of us have other work.
All right, let's start the show as usual with some follow-up. Copyright 2011, John Siracusa. APFS, iOS app updates have hit the App Store. Tell us about this, John.
Everyone's telling us about them. They're saying, hey, guess what? I downloaded the updated version of my favorite app, and the top thing in the release notes was fixed APS file name issues. We got many, many reports of many people sending us many applications that surprisingly feature APFS in their release notes. So the update is happening, even though the update was seamless for users, for developers, not exactly.
Actually, I think I might have hit one of these problems. So in the recent version of Overcast that's in the store as of like last week, I had to remove support for M4A chapters. And I forget whether I talked about it on this show or not. Did I talk about it here?
No, you just tweeted about it.
That's right. Anyway, so for AAC/M4A/MOV, John, chapters, I had to remove support for them temporarily, at least, until I can write my own parser, because the Apple parser kept crashing on some of the on a lot of the files that were doing that. And on iOS, you know, there's no way, as far as I know, there's no way for me to parse metadata like in a separate process or anything, so that if it crashes, my whole app doesn't come down. And I think the crashes seem to start around the time the 10.3 beta started, so it would not surprise me if this was file system related. And the reason I had to do all this, it was kind of a crazy hack, I'll try to tell quickly. Basically, when Overcast downloads its files, it downloads them with no extension. It just saves it as like, you know, a big ID number with no file extension, you know, no .mp3 or anything. The metadata parser from Apple in the API can only operate on a file name or URL, cannot operate just like on a data blob. So it knows about the file name. And if that file name does not end in .aac or .m4a, it doesn't work right, but only for those files. And if it's an MP3, it needs to end in that to work right. And so the solution I came up with was and also I don't always have the whole file. Sometimes I'm streaming the file, and so I have to just write out like the bit I have to a temp file, and then read the metadata from it, and then read and then delete the temp file. And then to get around the extension issue, when I'm reading the metadata from an M4A file, I create a symlink to it with a .m4a extension, read the file name, read the data off of that, and then delete the symlink. And it was at those parts that I was getting a lot of crashes all of a sudden in 10.3. So something's up with the way my app and or the metadata parsing library in iOS deals with me creating these symlinks or writing these little tiny temp files to disk that don't actually include the whole file. And it was causing the whole thing to crash sometimes. So I temporarily removed that support and left in only my own ID3 MP3 parser, which supports MP3 chapters, which is what this show uses, because that I can do all in memory with my own safe routines. But at some point, I have to figure out how to re-implement support for AAC chapters. And for the lack of them, I apologize to the entire nation of Germany. And I'm hoping to get that done quickly. But right now, there's a big problem with that. And I think it actually might be related to some bug somewhere, whether it's mine or Apple's, I'm not yet sure, regarding the file system, because it did not happen before 10.3.
Why don't you try switching from symlinks to hard links and see if that just magically fixes it?
Well, I was thinking that's, I'm not sure I want to even still be dealing with links. I think the better long-term, the longest-term fix is to write my own parser, but the problem is, without getting too far into this again, the AAC chapters format is completely undocumented and proprietary to Apple. I've tried to figure it out on numerous occasions in the past, and I've gotten most of it, but it's really, really tricky and really undocumented. And the bits of data that you need are all over the file. They aren't even all up front. Like, they're interspersed throughout the entire file, because it's structured in such a way that, like, as it's playing a track, like if it's playing a stream of a track, like if say the chapter changes and the chapter includes a URL and an image, then the URL and image are like spliced into the stream at that point in the audio data. So it might not, like,
what?
So you can't, so exactly, this is why this format sucks. So you can't even, and that same like splicing format also applies to the titles of the chapters. So you cannot build a table of contents reliably from an AAC chapter file unless you have the whole file, because you have to skip through the whole thing to get all the titles out.
That's bananas.
Yes, I know. It's a huge pain. In the MP3 chapter format, it's based on ID3 tags, which are very, very crude, but very, very simple to deal with. And they have a lot of limitations. It's very similar to like RSS versus ATOM feed formats like back in the day. Like, RSS is really simple, hence the name. But, you know, it had some limitations. And ATOM was designed to like be everything to everybody. And as a result, it's overly complicated and a huge pain in the butt. And that's kind of MP3 versus the MOV format, which is what AAC and M4A, that's all just renaming versions of the MOV format, basically, asterisk, but basically.
Once again, humans, he's trying to say MOV. He means a file that ends in .mov. Just so you're not listening to this and saying, what is he even saying? Because I know that's happening.
That's a color, isn't it?
Yeah, MOV has the most RAM. Yeah.
Wow. That's... That is my possible APFS bug in Overcast, and also why anybody listening, why your chapters in MOV format podcast might have stopped working in the recent update.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like an APFS thing, but who knows? It is a new file system, and if it is related to, like, it's not of the kind that people are talking about in the release notes, because they're all talking about encoding, file name encoding issues, but I'm assuming when you make these temp files, you're making them with ASCII file names, so it's totally not an issue for you.
Yeah, it's like the file name is the ID number of the file, .m4a.
Yeah.
Now, and so the other possible quick solution, if I want to do just a quick solution, just save all the files as .m4a, even when they're not, and just, you know, have a migration that runs on the first launch of the new version that just renames them all and just doesn't do any kind of hard linking or symlinking, just permanently leaves them as those names. But then that will break the MP3 file decoder sometimes under certain conditions. So it's like it, and the M4A/AAC/MOV/MOV, those are all, like, that format is, last time I checked, it was like less than 5% of all items in the iTunes directory. So it's like,
I think you mean the Apple Podcast directory.
Oh God, you're right. It's been like 2 hours. All right. So yeah, in the Apple Podcast directory, the vast majority, well over 90%, the format is MP3. So to do a whole bunch of work to accommodate AAC files in a special way, especially chapterized ones, we're talking a very small number of podcasts. I'm guessing off the top of my head, the total number of podcasts that are both chapterized and M4A format and that are listened to by anybody in Overcast is probably less than 100, maybe even less than 10. And so it's like, it's a question of whether I actually should do anything about this or not.
But isn't it like 90% of the podcasts in Germany?
See, and the Germans do use chapters heavily, and a few of them do use AAC chapters, but a lot of them use MP3 chapters or other formats that I don't even support, like the Podlove Simple Chapters format, which is a wonderful idea, but there's just, I don't have a lot of market push to support it really yet. The idea behind that, by the way, Podlove Simple Chapters, which is the idea basically is to put the chapter information in the feed rather than in the individual files. And that's a great idea, but there's almost no support for it on either side, on the producer side, on the CMS side, or on the podcast app player side. So that's, I don't know what I'm going to do about that, if anything, but chapters. I don't know. I waded into this chapter mess, and now I'm making a chapter tool, and now I have this chapter app, and now I'm stuck with parsing chapters forever.
Chapters all the way down.
It is. I do love the Germans, though.
They are great. Bringing it back around, talking more directly about APFS, Kyle Seth Gray, otherwise known as Kyle's the Gray, had tweeted at us a very interesting pair of screenshots. So he writes, here's my iOS disks before and after upgrading to 10.3. So it shows in the before that he has a capacity, or his disks are 86% full, 91% full, and 20% full. After upgrade, the same disks go from 86 to 40% from 20 to 8% full, which means somewhere out of nowhere, he now has more free space thanks to APFS.
You're looking at the wrong column in these screenshots.
My bad?
Yes, it's a lot of numbers. We'll put the link in the show notes. It's a tweet, and you can look at the screenshots. So the percentages are different, right? But, I mean, this is the output of, like, DF or whatever. And the key thing to look at, like, so there are some partitions that are not interesting to us, like dev for the devfs and the one at the bottom, which is like baseband data for wireless or whatever. But there are, you can see the OS and the user partitions, and the key column is size. Before iOS 10, the size of the first one, which is mounted at slash, is 4.3 gigs, and that's like the OS partition, I'm assuming. And the size of, like, the big one where all your stuff is 59 gigs. So 59 plus 4.3 gigs is like, this is a 64 gig phone, right? And then, you know, ancillary stuff left over for the other little partitions, right? After upgrade, the size of both the iOS and the your stuff partition, both of them say 64 gigs. So the OS partition, it's 64 gigs. And the user partition, it's 64 gigs. It's exactly what we were talking about. And this didn't occur to me before when I was talking about the sizing because I couldn't quite figure out how the numbers added up, but this makes perfect sense. If you have a 64 gig phone, it does what we were saying in the example last show with, like, if you had a 1 gig disk and you put 2 1 gig partitions, they have a 64 gig disk essentially in this phone, and they put 2 64 gig partitions on it. One of them for the OS and one of them for all the rest of your stuff, which is a reasonable simplification, because now they don't have to, like, think about, oh, geez, how big should the OS partition be? Like, how big is our OS? How much you know, should we use? Because in the pre-iOS 10.3 state, the size of the OS partition was 4.3 gigs, but only 3.6 was used. So they give themselves a little wiggle room, like if the next OS update is a little bigger, or they could resize the partitions. But with APFS, they don't have to worry about exactly how to size partitions. Both of them are 64 gigs. Both of them have, quote-unquote, the whole phone. And that messes up the capacity and how much is available measurements, depending on how you are going to report this information. So that could explain these discrepancies that we were seeing before. In particular, if you have 55 gigs used and you think the thing is 64 gigs, then you think you have more left than if it was a different size. Or it could just be DF totally confused by APFS. Either way, free space in APFS is weird.
Indeed. Moving on, NVIDIA job postings suggest an NVIDIA chip return to Apple Macs. John, I presume this is most interesting to you, so tell us about this.
We talked last show about NVIDIA releasing the Mac drivers for their new card and for the whole line of top-end cards, essentially, which is a weird thing to do because Apple doesn't even sell a computer that you can stick an NVIDIA card in, just older ones that people might still have hanging around. And something was tickling my mind about this, and a lot of people sent in this link from September 2016. Job posting. NVIDIA did a job posting. They were looking for someone to be a software engineer at NVIDIA, and the role would require, this is a quote from their job listing, working in partnership with Apple and writing code that will define and shape the future of graphics-related software on Macs. So they were looking for this in September, and now they've delivered a thing. So who knows when the Mac Pro decision was made? Who knows when this decision was made? But really, NVIDIA made a decision that previously we weren't doing much Mac stuff, but guess what? Now we're gonna. And again, it seems really weird that NVIDIA would make that decision on its own, because they have no market to sell into except for people with really old Macs. So, and especially saying working in partnership with Apple, it certainly seems like Apple was talking to NVIDIA sometime on or before September 23rd, 2016, saying, you know, come back. We miss you. let's kiss and make up, whatever our problem was. We want to get some of that sweet Pascal hardware in Macs someday. And this could have been well before they even decided to keep making a Mac Pro. So who knows? Maybe the iMac Pro will have NVIDIA stuff in it. I don't know. I'm getting my hopes up a little bit. But anyway, the mystery deepens. But this wasn't an overnight thing. And I think it's got to have some form of Apple's input, because I don't see any reason NVIDIA would do this on its own.
All right. Friend of the show, Kieran Healy, writes in regarding Marco at 43 minutes and 15 seconds of the last episode. And we'll put an Overcast link in the show notes. Quote, obviously, something has changed with Apple's thinking on release schedule since 2012. Around then, everything slowed down. This is paraphrased. Around then, everything slowed down, but now something has changed to make Apple flip around. So Kieran pontificates, I wonder if it was Project Titan, which is ostensibly the car project. Perhaps that swallowed up a lot of resources. Last I heard, maybe 9 months ago, it sounded like that was getting at least substantially scaled back. It was surprising not to hear on the show, but also elsewhere in the news coverage I read, any discussion of the possibility that the Apple car project was the black hole that absorbed hardware design talent and effort for 2 to 3 years with no results as yet, and that had significant opportunity costs for every piece of hardware the company makes apart from the iPhone. Thoughts on that?
Any kind of massive project like this, like Apple trying to make a car and then a self-driving car, that's going to draw talent from the rest of the company, no question. However, I think a large part of the talent that was or is working on that was probably from external sources. It's probably like, you know, from external hires, from acquisitions, places like that. I don't think the team that was working on the Mac Pro or would have updated the Mac Mini otherwise or was trying to ship new laptops 2 years earlier, you know, I don't think those people went to go work on the car project, and that's why those things didn't happen. You know, it's probably more complicated than that. Also, I bet Project Titan has not actually gone away or anything, or necessarily been scaled back. I think it was just rethought based on what we've actually heard and what actually makes more sense. But anyway, I'm guessing that these are at least partially separate. That the product slowdown that we have seen was not probably a direct result of Project Titan sucking talent out of the company. I think it's way more likely that it was a combination of operational screw-ups somewhere along the way, and also decisions up top that were basically along the lines of, we don't think these are worth doing.
For Project Titan being scaled back, like regardless of the current size of it, because of the change in direction that was rumored, I think a lot of people got laid off. Like, we don't need people who know how to build a car if we're not building a car anymore. But all of a sudden, we do need people who know how to write software that other people in the audio industry are going to consume or whatever. But yeah, the main reason I put this in the show notes is to ask the question. And, you know, it's, people have this question a lot. I think we've talked about it a few times in the past. But you're always looking for something to blame for the product that you want to be updated or worked on or become prominent not getting the attention it deserves, and it's easy to blame it on the mysterious, you know, potentially very large secret operation going on to make a car. But I'm on the same page with Marco. I think projects like this do take talent away, they take attention away, attention of the executives and the attention of the employees. But in general, if any project was going to be it was going to contain a large proportion of new employees who are new to Apple or who would not be working on the Mac at all, it's a car project. Because, yeah, there's going to be smart people who you're like, well, we want some of these people because they're just smart people and they're just good software people, so we'll definitely take them, right? But it's not, I think it's not the same thing as, for example, when iOS stole a lot of resources from the Mac, because they're the same core OS under the covers, right? And making a GUI operating system, even though one is touch and one is mouse, they're so closely related. They share code, they share concepts, whereas the car is far enough away that I feel like the worst thing you can probably blame it for is distracting executives, perhaps. But I think it is a separate issue than why are Macs taking a long time to update all of a sudden, or, you know, why are these other products being emphasized or de-emphasized? I mean, if you want to blame anything, you could blame like the watch or something, like another product that is closer to the Mac than the car is, to say, you know, because there was, you know, the watch was behind schedule a little bit, according to the rumors of when Apple wanted it to be released. And there's a little fire drill about software and all sorts of other stuff. So I don't blame the car or the whatever it is now at all.
We are sponsored this week by MailRoute, my favorite email spam filtering service. For a free 30-day trial, go to MailRoute.net/ATP. You know who should handle your email security and delivery? People who do only that, and that's MailRoute. The big companies have bowed out of the email protection business because it's hard work. There was Postini, McAfee, MX Logic. MailRoute's team has been focused entirely on email security since 1997. I was still in middle school. High school. Still, that was a long time ago. MailRoute protects your email and hardware against spam, viruses, and other threats, and they deliver your mail even if your mail server cannot. There's no hardware or software to install. If you own your own domain, all you got to do is point the MX records at MailRoute and then tell MailRoute servers where to deliver your clean, filtered mail. The interface is very easy to navigate and loaded with admin tools. There's even an API if you need that. And all this is designed to make your life better as an email administrator. No spam, no viruses, and no bounced mail. And also, if you are just an individual like me, you know, I don't run an email server for anybody else, but I do buy my own email service, and their built-in spam filtering isn't very good. MailRoute's is the best I've ever seen. So you just put MailRoute in front of any other IMAP host or your own email servers, and they clean out all the spam and viruses for you, and deliver to you is almost no spam. It is incredibly rare that a piece of spam actually hits my mailbox. And believe me, this mail account's been around for a long time. It is shocking how effective MailRoute has been since I put it on there probably about a year ago now. I absolutely love MailRoute. So whether you're running a big server or a group of servers and you need lots of filtering to save yourself hardware costs for all those server loads, or if you're just an individual user with an email service that you pay for and you want better spam filtering than what it provides, I highly suggest MailRoute. So check it out today. Stop spam with a free 30-day trial at MailRoute.net/ATP. And listeners of this show, if you use that link, MailRoute.net/ATP, you will get 10% off for the lifetime of your account. So every time they charge you for your membership fee, you get 10% off. That's an incredible deal. MailRoute.net/ATP. Thanks a lot.
Friend of the show, Greg Pierce, had noticed something interesting about the Clips app, which I was able to talk about briefly last episode before we dove into 3 hours of Mac Pro Talk. He noted that Clips did not ask permission to use his camera or microphone, and he said, bad form, Apple, which I agree with. Kay writes in reply to Greg, it's a deliberate choice made by Apple. They granted Clips special entitlements to access camera, mic, contacts, etc. without asking. And there's a screenshot of what I believe to be, it's in the entitlements of the Clips app, and it has a key, com.apple.private.tcc.allow, which has entries such as KTCC service photos and camera and microphone, etc., which is an interesting special case that we aren't allowed to do that blesses Clips and gives Clips access to your mic and camera and contacts and whatnot without the user actively having done so, which, I mean, obviously it's Apple's right to do that, but I don't know. I kind of wish that they would just play by the same rules as everyone else.
Yeah, so this is not a new thing with Clips. Tons of Apple apps do this, but it's just, it's worth highlighting again, in case people didn't know, you know, obviously Apple runs the platform. They can do whatever the hell they want, right? And they do. Like, I mean, they put Xcode on the Mac App Store, for crying out loud. Like, Xcode is in slight violation of a couple of Mac App Store rules that apply to other applications. But for this specific case, and for iOS apps like this in particular, I think like it's an interesting object lesson for the policies they have, in that clearly someone at Apple who is making Clips thought that not having to ask for permission to access the camera and the microphone and, you know, your contacts and your photos and stuff like that is a better user experience for the app. Like, forget about whether they have the ability to get rid of, to put these secret entitlements in or not. Like, it's a design question. Is this app better when it asks for permission, or is this app better when it doesn't ask for permission? And it seems like this is an interface decision. This is a nicer experience for users if we don't ask for permission, right? But because only Apple gets to make that, it's kind of like they're saying, not only do we, Apple, get to do secret things you don't get to do, but because we get to do those secret things, our applications have a nicer user experience than yours can ever have. Because the first thing you have to do on first launch is throw a bunch of dialogues in someone's face and say, can I do this? Can I do this? Can I do this? And users don't like that. And we get to bypass that, but you because you are untrustworthy, must have a worse user experience. And needless to say, the vast majority of applications downloaded from the App Store are not made by Apple. And so it's like, every application except for Apple's has to have a worse user experience. Now, I don't know what the solution is, because you do want applications asking for permission. You don't want applications to be able to secretly use your camera and get at your photos, right? But it's an interesting dilemma, because it's like Apple is choosing not to eat its own dog food and follow its own rules, not because they're flouting their power, but because I think they really believe this makes a better application. And so, yeah, I think this is evidence of a rethinking, even if it's just a very minor rethinking of how permission is asked for and granted, because perhaps the most obtrusive way to do anything on iOS is to throw a modal dialogue on top of everything. And I'm not sure what the answer is. Would it be better if it like slid down or had a different appearance? Would it be better if there was some other way that these permissions manifested? Maybe when you download the app, you could give it something, or users could. I don't even know. I don't know what the solution is. I just thought it was it highlighted this user interface issue more so than the technical thing, because again, tons of Apple apps do this.
Finally, a t-shirt update. So if you are listening to this episode, either live or recorded, it doesn't matter. You're probably listening to it sometime before April 26th. If you are listening to this episode right now and you want a t-shirt and you have not ordered it, please order it now. I cannot tell you the amount of times we've heard people say either, oh, I had no idea the t-shirts were for sale, or, oh, I meant to get one, but then I just plumb forgot. Don't be that person. Order a t-shirt. Yes, this is incredibly self-serving. Yes, I acknowledge that. But I am so sick of people saying, oh, I didn't have any idea, or, oh, I forgot. Don't forget. Please, if it's April 26th of 2017, before April 26th of 2017, you're listening to the show, please, if you are interested, buy a t-shirt. Now, John, can you give us a little bit of details on what's going on with those? Because there's been a couple of changes since we last spoke.
Yeah, but first I have to remind myself to listen to your advice, because for the past like week, I've been like, you know what? I need to order shirts too.
Same here, actually.
I too have not ordered my shirts.
Don't be like us. Okay. Don't be like us.
We know when we stop selling these shirts, even we can't order them again.
that's really true.
Yeah.
We will be out of luck. So here's what happened since the last show. I talked about how we might be changing things to, instead of taking all of your orders for 20 something days and then, you know, after the sale ends, sending this huge giant shipment of shirts out to everybody. Instead, we might switch to sort of a continuous fulfillment type of thing. And that is what we've done. It's like an every 3 days type of thing. And that manifests on the Teespring site saying, this sale ends in 2 days. This sale ends in 1 day. And many people keep sending us tweets panicked. Oh, no, it says it ends in 1 day or in 2 days. But you said it was going to end on the 26th. Very often these people have already ordered their shirt. They're just trying to look out for other people to say, like, or look out for us and say, you might not know it, but you have your stuff misconfigured. Well, what happens is when it ends, it just immediately relaunches for another 3 day window. And this is going to repeat until the 26th ish. So don't fret if it says you have 2 days remaining or 1 day remaining. Look at the calendar. If it is the 26th or before, you can still order. If it's after the 26th, take seriously any things you see on the site. This is just the way it works on the site. I wish we could have said continuous fulfillment, but with a definitive end date, but we can't, because this is not how the site works. So never fear. It's a rolling cycle that repeats every 3 days ish. And the other thing I wanted to mention, because Teespring itself mentioned it to us, one of the shirts that we sell in our bazillion different color varieties here, which, by the way, we didn't point this out, but when we sort of did this accidentally, which is appropriate. usually we have some kind of silly in-joke, Apple-related in-joke for our shirts for the past couple of years. This year, the silly unintentional in-joke was that our shirt names and the million varieties are like the million different varieties of Apple product names. It's like MacBook, two USB ports, 2013, you know, late 2013 or whatever. So that's what our shirts are like, and we have a million different varieties. Anyway, one of them is what we call the jet black shirt, which is, obviously an allusion to the new phone color for the iPhone 7. And the jet black shirt is a black t-shirt, and the printing on it is also in black. And that's the joke. It's completely black. If this is not clear to you that it is black printing on a black t-shirt, it will be basically invisible. Like, if you're buying this shirt and you get it and you're like, hey, I can't see anything on this shirt because it's black ink printed on black. That's the joke. It's a jet black. It's, you know, how much more black could the shirt be? And the answer is none. None more black, which is a different joke. Or reference, if not joke. Anyway, so Teespring was encouraging us very strongly to not sell a shirt with black printing on black because customers get it and they're angry because they can't see anything on it. And I had faith in our customers and say, I hope they get the joke that it's a jet black shirt and it does have black printing. And you can see it in the picture. Like, it's not a secret that it's black printing on black. But needless to say, if you see that shirt and you're wondering, is this black printing on a black shirt and will this be hard to see? Yes, it's black printing on a black shirt and it will be super duper hard to see. And that's the joke. Enjoy.
All right. So, yes. So if you are listening to this, do not be like Casey, John, and Marco. Don't be us. Be better than us, which is not a very hard thing to do. Go to atp.fm/shirt and buy you a shirt if you are so inclined. That definitely helps us on the show. And we thank you to anyone who has even considered doing so. But please blame only the mirror if you miss the window, because this one's on you.
Although you should be like us in that when you actually do order shirts, you should order like five of them, like all of us are going to do.
That's true.
I think I'm getting ones for my kids for the first year. My daughter said she might want one. She likes the rainbow one, like everybody else.
John, didn't you not even buy yourself the edition shirt 2 years ago?
No, that was me.
No, I totally did. I've got an edition. I'm part of the elite.
Are you kidding? I was way too cheap to buy an edition shirt.
Casey didn't buy an edition. See, let's think about who's actually cheap here. I did buy an edition.
Yeah, that's just don't be like us kids.
They just go into the t-shirt museum, though. I haven't actually worn it, you know.
I think I've worn mine like twice. Like, I'm afraid to wear it too much. I don't want to wear it out because it's gold.
It's a valuable t-shirt. Almost as valuable as a Cotton Borough Cheap Bureau t-shirt shipped to Europe, right?
Sick burn.
Yeah, no, the real valuable t-shirt for people who haven't been keeping up with the t-shirts is the very first t-shirt we ever printed where there was a printing error on it. And so everybody who got that t-shirt got like the equivalent of the upside down airplane on the stamp thing, right? Where it's a misprinted, incorrectly made shirt. And then all those same people got a second shirt correctly printed for free.
Yeah.
So those people got two sheets for the shirts for the price of one. And they also got a special collector's item, never to be reproduced printing error shirt. So kudos to those people. Put those into the shirt museum.
Oh, goodness. All right. Any other follow-up? John, the keeper of the follow-up, anything else you'd like to add?
No, we're at the end. You see it. You can see it.
You know, John isn't only the keeper of the follow-up.
Mm-hmm. I'm heavily credited.
Mm.
All right. Apple has apparently patented a USB-C MagSafe-style adapter, which is super-duper exciting for those of us like myself who even though I don't have a USB-C laptop, I can tell you I will miss having MagSafe because it saved my bacon a bunch of times. So do we have any thoughts on this?
Why are you excited by it? That's the first question.
Because I feel like I have had my laptop saved and or legs saved many, many, many times by the MagSafe adapter that's been on my laptop on my laptops. So this looks like it would bring it back, which would be great.
You need MagSafe for cups of water, but they don't have that yet.
Ooh, that is true. Yes.
So the reason Sick I think bird. You should not be excited about it is because, as we've said many times, Apple patents everything. Patents have no real bearing on anything that Apple will produce, especially if you see the patent before the product. It's a good chance that there's not a product related to that. But the reason I put it in here is not because I think Apple will make such a thing, although Belkin and a few other companies, I think, actually do make this exact thing that you're seeing here, which is like a little thing that plugs into USB-C and has a little MagSafe-y kind of magnet snap-off-y thing on the end.
Yeah, Griffin is the one you're thinking of. And
Griffin?
It's unfortunately, it's not very well regarded.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the same idea, though. It's just the implementation may not be good because it is actually tricky to get this stuff right. The reason I think it's interesting is because back when we knew they were dropping MagSafe, but none of us had actually seen the products yet, and we hadn't really used the USB-C, we're like, well, you know, MagSafe is great and everybody loves it, but it is bigger, and maybe USB-C, the connectors will just yank out just as easily as MagSafe does, because it's a whole new connector. It's not like a big USB-A connector. You know, who knows what it'll be like? But now that we all have experience with USB-C, I think it's pretty safe to say it does not come out as easily as MagSafe in any way, shape, or form.
No.
And that the hazard of tripping over your cord that's connected through USB-C to your laptop is back. It used to be mostly gone with MagSafe, depending on the angle that you trip over it on. But now the danger is back. And I think USB-C, kind of like AirPods, is one of those little things that seems like, oh, whatever, you know, wireless earphones, or, you know, oh, magnet instead of plugging it in, that seems nice. But I think MagSafe was mostly universally beloved. The only complaints I ever heard about MagSafe were from couch chargers, people who use their, you know, thing connected on their couch or like with a big comforter or blanket, and they would say it was a little bit too loose and that like it would knock it out unintentionally. But that's the only bad thing I've ever heard about MagSafe. And for a connector and a technology that looks, if you just, you know, look at it, it looks like weird and delicate in the same way that lightning does, and that like you look in it, it's like, so it's a magnet and these, you know, this little tiny set of contacts inside there, and all the power to this laptop is going through these tiny little pinprick point things. That just seems so much less robust than what if stuff gets in there and so on and so forth. But I've had MagSafe on many, many devices and still have it on many of them, and I still think it's a great idea, well executed. Again, you know, modulo the looseness of like MagSafe 2 and other issues like that. And I think it's pretty beloved. I think people like Apple products because they have MagSafe. It was another one of those Apple things like that makes it better than just a regular laptop. And when it went away and when we discovered that there is no real replacement for it, it's just like, well, that advantage is now gone. You know, it kind of made their laptops worse in a way. And in some tiny way, it made their laptops worse. And Apple having a patent like this makes me think that at the very least, somewhere inside the company, they said, can we go all USB-C, but also retain the advantages of MagSafe somehow by the answer to everything that is the answer in the world of USB-C, which is let's make an adapter. And so they did and patented it, but, you know, decided not to ship it for whatever reason, because maybe it's still kind of clunky or whatever. Anyway, all this is to say that I wish, instead of doing this adapter and going USB-C everywhere and then not shipping this adapter and leaving to third parties, I wish they had come up with MagSafe 3. If MagSafe is too big and clunky and your devices are getting thinner and thinner, can you come up with some other solution that also uses magnets that has all the same advantages? And we haven't seen a patent for that, but clearly nothing they've shipped reflects that. Anyway, all I'm saying is I miss MagSafe and I wish it would come back. And it seems like at least some contingent inside Apple also misses MagSafe because they tried to do something to bring it back.
If you're going to do MagSafe on USB-C, the solution is not to have this weird little stick-out, like, half-inch-long adapter that you need to also have with you or stick on your cables and have that break away. No, that's, like, anything that involves, like, a rigid adapter against a USB port, I think is not a good idea long-term because it's so easily just, like, you know, breaks off in the port or something else. Like, all those USB hubs that were designed first for the MacBook One that, like, literally just, like, attach right next to it, like, flush against the case and have this big, long hub down the side. Like, that's just asking for it to have your knee push against that or something and have the end of the cable snap off into the socket. Like, anything like that I think is a bad idea. And I think the relatively mediocre reception of the Griffin thing that looks just like this is, I think, reinforcing of that. To me, if you're going to have this problem you have now, which is you're not going to have a dedicated magnetic charging port anymore, you're just going to charge through any USB-C port, then you can't make them all magnetic because, you know, that's not how USB-C works. But you can do an innovation that Microsoft figured out in 2001, I think, which is whenever the Xbox One came out. And I don't mean the Xbox O-N-E. I mean the Xbox number one, the first Xbox. And that was, you put the magnetic splitter thing a few inches away from the console in the cable. You know, in a similar location that many cables would have one of those, drum-shaped, like, magnetic interference reducer things, you know? A few inches from the connector head, you have a little, like, breakaway thing that if you pull it the wrong way, it opens up. It's like MagSafe, you know, 6 inches into a cable, basically. That worked great on the Xbox. And I'm sure, you know, it wouldn't be like the most like visually pristine thing, but neither is like this world full of crazy adapters we have now. The adapters are all ugly and stupid and clunky, right? So if you move it away from the port by a few inches onto the cable, you have all of the same safeties of MagSafe. But you get it away from the laptop body, it then works fine on any USB-C port, and it doesn't require the use of these little fragile adapters.
Back when we talked about this originally, this actually wasn't the most popular one, although you did bring it up back then, too, because you have this absurd love for that huge console.
It was a great console!
The most common thing that people brought up was the opposite of having the magnetic thing at the other end, like at the other far end, rather than in the middle somewhere, like at basically at the part where it plugs into the, you know, the white brick thingy, you know. But I think both middle and the other end are worse solutions than just MagSafe 3 on the laptop, because middle and the other end are both much more likely to be in inaccessible places. You know the end that's where the laptop is accessible because you can get at the laptop, right? You put a laptop on the desk. You have to be able to reach the laptop to type on it and use the trackpad. That means you can also reach the part where you plug and unplug the little plug thing. And if it becomes undone because something, you know, because you yank it or something knocks it or whatever, you just plug it right back in. Like, and I think part of the experience with MagSafe that makes it good is not just the breakaway ability, but that it is a pleasing way to connect and disconnect with a little magnet, which is a frequent operation. Infrequently, someone will trip over it. Very frequently, you will plug and unplug it. And I think it's more pleasant to plug, even just being able to just yank it out to unplug it and not having to be careful or slide straight out or worry about bending things or whatever. So that's part of what I love about MagSafe. And it's part of the reason why I don't like middle, because who can get at the middle when someone does trip over it and like some end of it is going to tuck behind something. It's going to be a pain in the butt to try to find it again. And I don't like the other end because the other end is probably in a power brick that's either in a wall socket or at least close to it. Also harder to get to. And middle is ugly because, you know, it's just Johnny Ive would never like it. He doesn't want the big bulge in the middle of things. So I still come down strongly in favor of MagSafe 3, as in have an actual MagSafe port on the laptops and have a MagSafe thing that plugs into it. Just make it a new size that fits in. I mean, if you make it the size of USB-C, then you're like, well, this will last as long as USB-C does, because as soon as we're too thin for USB-C, we would have been in the same situation anyway. But instead, Apple has done nothing, including not shipping this adapter. And as Marco said, the one that is out there does not get good reviews. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to make a good adapter. It just means that one is not as good as real MagSafe was.
We are sponsored this week by Jamf Now. That's JAMF.com/ATP for Jamf Now, which helps you manage your Apple devices from anywhere. Now, when you first start your business, it's pretty easy to keep track of your own computer and your own phone, but that doesn't really scale. As you grow and as you start to buy more tech for your employees, it gets a lot harder to keep track of everybody's Macs, iPhones, and iPads. Figuring out how to secure, for example, the iPad that your sales rep just lost, this can be tough, especially when you're in different locations. Jamf Now makes that and a lot more much easier. You can configure settings, you can protect sensitive information, you can even lock or wipe devices remotely from anywhere. Jamf Now secures your stuff so you can focus on your business instead, and this does not require any IT expertise. It's incredibly easy to use. ATP listeners can start securing your business today. You can set up the first 3 devices for free, and adding more is just $2 a month per device. It's really easy and it's really affordable. Create your free account today and see for yourself at jamf.com/ATP. That's JAMF.com/ATP. Thanks a lot to Jamf for sponsoring our show.
So there was an interesting development today as we record this, if I'm not mistaken, which as you're listening to this might be like a week ago, but today it was announced that it's official. iTunes Podcasts is now Apple Podcasts, and there's new badges that you can use and so on and so forth. And so Jason Snell has started to wonder, is this the beginning of the end for iTunes? And what does that really mean? So I certainly don't know. I can't say I would be bitter if iTunes either went away or, more accurately, the app just got split up several ways. But I mean, this is some pretty heavy reading of the tea leaves. What do you think, Marco?
I mean, this all might be leading to something big, or it might just be like, you know, iTunes is not as strong of a brand as it used to be anymore. You know, we like when they launched the new streaming music service, they didn't call it new iTunes Music. They called it Apple Music.
You know, just call it the iTunes Music 2013 or whatever year it was. Right. And then the next year it would just be called new iTunes Music.
Yeah, exactly. like, you know, it could be part of some part of, you know, like a big grand like iTunes deprecation plan where everything branded as iTunes is being replaced by separate things. And that would be cool. But I don't think this is evidence of that. It might be, you know, I think we will be able to look back at this in retrospect if that comes to pass and say, oh, that was the beginning of it. But yeah, right now, I don't think we can really say anything except that we've been hearing rumblings for a while. Apple is working on some kind of updates to their podcasting, you know, division or whatever. And some of those are going to be enhancements for publishers, most of which have been totally unspecified so far. But we know that they're working on something for podcasts. So this is just one step of that in all likelihood, just the very first step of now it's Apple Podcasts to go along with Apple Music. I don't think this really means anything yet.
So I think this is kind of actually like a lagging, it's the wrong phrase, not a lagging indicator, but like that this change in branding from iTunes Podcast to Apple Podcasts is actually something that's overdue. Like it is catching up to the reality, and the reality is that on all these podcast sites, whether you see the subscribe in Overcast and subscribe in iTunes, like that's the other little badge button that you would hit, like that the iTunes brand being associated with podcast is past the point of being mostly nonsensical, because iTunes, like we just know it because historically speaking, the iTunes podcast directory was important for podcasting, and it's also a very important, popular, authoritative index of podcasts these days. And it happened to appear first in an application that we know as iTunes, but that no longer has any relevance, if it ever did, to podcasts. It barely has any relevance to music anymore, which is why Apple Music is called Apple Music, right? That the iTunes brand in all its forms, both in association with music in an application or association with podcasts or any other things that it has done, doesn't make sense in the current Apple ecosystem. And so to continue to have branding and promotional materials and website buttons and marketing communications and everything with the iTunes name in it is, you know, is not a good idea, and they should have stopped doing it a long time ago. And so now I think their branding is catching up with that. I think their product should also eventually catch up with it as well. Like it has a lot on the phone. There's still icons on the phone that say iTunes, but the fact that they broke out the TV app and that Apple TV is called, you know, Apple TV instead of ITV, and that they have podcasts broken out, and, you know, like, I'm gonna say the rats are fleeing the sinking ship of iTunes, but they've been leaving for a long, long, long time, and eventually all that will be left is this weird bloated Mac application. Like, it might even leave, you know, iOS home screens, and then the only thing left will be the Mac application, and that probably has the least resources to ever refactor it. But I'm all for them both rebranding and restructuring this. But even if they don't do that, and even if this is just a simple rebranding exercise, good, because it's time to rebrand these things and to divorce them from iTunes. It's a name that doesn't have it. The only connotations the name has for anybody who remembers it are like dated connotations. Like, oh yeah, I remember buying my first things on iTunes. Anyway, now I subscribe to Spotify, and when I see iTunes Podcasts, it's like podcasts, kind of like that old thing I used to do with music. Doesn't make any sense. So iTunes has served Apple well, but, you know, once Apple itself has switched its preeminent music service away from the iTunes brand, that's the day the iTunes brand died, and now all we're doing now is just, you know, letting the rest of the product catch up with it.
I mean, I would say it was even earlier than that. I would say, like, you know, like it did make sense to say for a podcast, subscribe in iTunes. In the early days of podcasting, before there was all this mobile listening, when you were mostly listening by literally subscribing in the iTunes app on a Mac or Windows and syncing them to your iPod to listen to. So that made sense then. But
that was so painful then, though. So
it
painful.
Was. That was a bad time. I mean, it was great for the time, you know, in the sense like DOS was great for its time. Anyway, so
I don't know if it was great for the time, because I can't think of it a single time.
Oh, here we go.
There's always, like, so here's the thing. Syncing songs to my iPod back in the days, like, oh, you've got your iPod with a monochrome LCD screen and a click wheel, or, you know, a mechanical spinning wheel, like first gen iPod. Putting songs on that by connecting it with a FireWire cable to your Mac, and, you know, iTunes would see it and syncing things to it. I mean, it's clunky, but that was the tech. The problem with podcasts is they are a regularly published thing. Like, they're a feed. It's not like you put your songs on your iPod, you put your podcast on your iPod and you have them. There's never any putting your podcast on your iPod. There's always more podcasts, like every day of the week if you're subscribed to a lot of them. Whereas new songs weren't arriving in your iTunes collection every day of the week unless you spend a lot of your time buying music. So it was so painful to know to have to constantly have this mental keep in your head the state of whatever is on your iPod. Oh, when's the last time I synced? Is the new episode of Show X on there? Do I have to sync again? Did I remember to sync before I left the house? It was a terrible fit. And so I never remember liking it, whereas I remember definitely liking syncing music onto it. Maybe because my music collection, again, doesn't change that frequently, but I never liked it with podcasts. And all I can remember is all the times that I was disappointed that I didn't have the most recent episode of the show I wanted to listen to on my iPod at the time.
Right, or you were like about to run out the door. You're like about to be late for work. Like, imagine
you can't stand a 20-minute iTunes sync.
Yeah, like imagine how many people in the world were collectively 5 minutes late to work during that time because they were waiting for their iPod to finish syncing the new podcast episodes.
And you couldn't tell. Just put that one episode on. It would be like, nope, gotta do syncing. It's going to be a while. Step 5 of 7. Stop.
Yeah. Anyway, so back, it did make sense to say subscribe in iTunes for a podcast back then. But because as you said, like because the podcast, the iTunes brand was never really used on iOS. Like there is the iTunes app, but that's basically like the video and movie store, right? Or like it's like how you can buy music, videos, and movies on the phone. You know, that's the only place that the iTunes name was ever used on iOS. So to say subscribe in iTunes for a podcast now makes very little sense, because what does that mean to anybody using a phone? Like almost all podcast listening is happening on mobile these days. Mobile has destroyed desktop and other listening. You know, almost everything happens on mobile. So if you tell somebody with a podcast, or if you tell a podcast listener subscribe in iTunes, there's a very good chance they don't know what you're talking about. So I think this makes a lot of sense just as a thing that they probably should do for podcasts. And I wouldn't read anything more into it than that, because there might be something more to it, but there's also a very good reason for them to have done it on their own. We are sponsored this week by Betterment, investing made better. Go to betterment.com/ATP to learn more. Betterment is a smarter way to invest your money, providing investment advice through smart technology, automated investing service, and human advisors. Betterment has changed the industry by using the same strategies that financial advisors use with clients with millions of dollars, but now made available to everyone. This includes smart rebalancing, global diversification, tax-efficient strategies, and much more. Betterment's mission is to help you manage and grow your investments to build your financial future, all with low fees, so you get to lose less of your money along the way. If you do the math, typical investment fees and costs really add up over time. Betterment's fees are a fraction of the cost of other financial services. And Betterment is so easy to use, they've won awards for their customer experience. You can see for yourself by logging into a demo account if you want to, right on their website. For a limited time, sign up with Betterment and you may qualify for a free Canary home security system to help you secure your home. Terms and conditions do apply, and investing involves risk. To learn more, visit betterment.com/ATP. That's betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, investing made better.
Peter Beardsley wrote in probably 18 years ago, and he said, a few years back when the Wii U sales were slumping, we were all doubting the future of Nintendo. John said something along the lines of, quote, as long as there's still a viable market for dedicated game consoles, Nintendo can survive. These days, they seem to be doing more than just surviving. Breath of the Wild, oh, this must not have been that long ago then. Breath of the Wild is a fantastic game that turned me back into a believer. Taking into account Super Mario Run, the Switch, and Breath of the Wild, what grade would John assign the company? Is he bullish about Nintendo's future? That means you're happy about it, right? I always get bearish and bullish backwards.
Yeah.
Anyway, how does he feel about their upcoming paid online service, which I didn't even know about? Email finishes, the people want to know, and now I am one of the people. So, John, how do you feel about Nintendo?
I had to give them a grade. I would still give them like a B- or so. And here's why. First of all, the Switch is still, I mean, it's doing well by all accounts, but it's still too early to call because they're still in the afterglow of their launch, which launched with one of the best games that Nintendo has ever made. Everyone loves Breath of the Wild. Universally good reviews. I love it. It's great. but does it have legs? How is it going to, what's the Switch going to be selling like 3 or 4 years from now? Is it going to have the longevity that you would expect of a console in the past, let alone the longevity of today's consoles, which seem to have second lives when you get like the PS4 Pro and Scorpio and all that stuff, where it's technically the same console, but it's a bumped up version. Like it's extending the life, like give these consoles more time. Whereas the Wii U did not have a long life and was not very successful. The thing about the Switch and Breath of the Wild that makes me downgrade their grade perhaps by a lot in terms of making dedicated game consoles is Breath of the Wild was the game that was originally announced for the Wii U, and it was developed with Wii U specific features. So like there would be stuff on the gamepad and also stuff on the TV screen and motion control for the aiming and all sorts of other stuff like that. And because of the short life of the Wii U and because of the rapid necessary development of its replacement, the Switch, Nintendo had to change things around and take out the Wii U. They didn't have to do this, but this is what they did. Take out the Wii U specific features for the Wii U version because they don't want the Wii U version to seem like it's the better version. They want, you want the Switch version to be the better version. And the Switch doesn't have a separate gamepad and TV, although if they had designed it differently, it could have, because you've got all the hardware there, but it doesn't. It's got, if you put it in its little cradle, you can see it on the TV, and if you hold it on your hand, that's where it is. You don't have a two-screen experience with the Switch for this game. And so Breath of the Wild, as fantastic as it is, could have been a PS4 game. And the exact same game, it would have better graphics and a better frame rate. It could have been a PS4 game. And that has not been true for the most part of Nintendo's breakout hits in the modern era. The Nintendo 64 and Mario 64 and the analog stick, like, that is all of a piece. You cannot put out Mario 64 on the SNES or Sega Genesis or, anything like that, because the whole game is designed around not just 3D hardware, but also the controllers and other, like the hardware and the software went together to provide the innovative experience. Wii is an obvious, much more modern example. The Wii doesn't exist without the hardware. It's hardware and software together. The GameCube, I would say, is Apple's most technologically successful traditional console in that it was just playing a good, competitive, powerful console with a good controller at a good price, well designed for profitability. Straight down the middle, like basically what Microsoft has always done with its consoles, right? In recent years, starting with the Wii, though, Nintendo has been making less powerful consoles and trying to concentrate and innovate in other areas. And the Switch is certainly innovative with its portable and non-portable, that advancement. But that advancement does not dictate so far, for the most part, a particular gameplay experience, especially since I don't even know if you're allowed to do this, but especially since the games that have been released so far don't say you can only play this in portable mode because it requires a touchscreen. They're also playable on the television, which means you can't make a game that requires a touchscreen that is also able to be played on the TV, and then it's no longer a Switch, it is just a portable game, right? Maybe that Nintendo will allow people to do that eventually, but as far as I'm aware, for now, they're not allowing people to do that. All which is to say that I haven't seen any synergy between software and the hardware, which means the advantage I was talking about Nintendo, like as long as there's a market for a dedicated game consoles, Nintendo can be successful and survive, because then they can do that thing that Nintendo has always done, which is make an amazing product that requires a synergy of hardware and software, somewhat like Apple has, had a reputation for doing over the many years. But Breath of the Wild could have been a PS4 game and probably would have been better on PS4. And I would have been happier if Breath of the Wild ran on hardware that was more powerful. Now that's just me. Some people may want a really good portable system, in which case they don't want Breath of the Wild on PS4. They want it on Switch because they love playing it in a portable thing on the go and, upstairs in the bed or whatever. Like, that makes it a successful handheld, but again, doesn't say anything specific about it other than why couldn't it have been sorry, Sony. I can't even remember the name of your stupid most recent handheld that is not successful. Chat room, what the hell is the Vita? Sorry.
Is it the NSX?
Jeez, no, the Vita. PlayStation Vita. And didn't they have one? Was the one after the Vita? God, I can't even keep track. This lag is killing me. I think the Vita is the most recent. Anyway, people who love the handheld, they're, there have been handhelds before. Now, I understand the Switch thing, being able to take off the little controls and use them separately, so there is some innovation there, but it doesn't have the same synergy with the games as other stuff has had. It doesn't mean it's not going to, because this is very early days. New games are going to come out all the time, and we'll see how they go. And they're, you know, the Switch is successful, people like it, the software is good, it can still be a successful product, but my personal grade for it is that they are not competitive with the two other big consoles. The Nintendo was always an also-ran because they make less powerful hardware. And within the realm of less powerful hardware, their track record of being able to make innovations that have profound effects on gameplay and vice versa has been hit or miss over the years. And the Switch is kind of like a base hit in that people like it and it does what it's supposed to do well, but it seems like it is just a way for you to play the same old console games that you could always play portably and on the TV, which is an innovation because that's what people like about it. Like, I don't have to choose between some cut-down portable game versus a full-fledged TV one, but that innovation succeeds by being somewhere in the middle. It's not as good on the TV as the dedicated TV consoles, but it's better portably than some of the weaker-powered portable consoles also still made by Nintendo, like the 3DS. So, it may be the right product at the right time, and certainly I think we can all say that it has a brighter future, as far as anyone can tell, than the Wii U did. And the Wii U was arguably much more innovative. It just, you know, the game sort of never materialized. But I think this launch and the fact they had to make the Switch and the fact that they had to cut out the features from the Wii U version so it didn't appear to be the better version of the game than the Switch version are all kind of disappointing markers of this difficult period in Nintendo's history. But I'm glad they're recovering after the Wii U, and I'm glad the Switch does appear to be more successful, and I wish them all the success in the world. I just wish they would... the product that I want them to make is not the Switch, but if the Switch is what they have to make for me to get Breath of the Wild to make them successful again, you know, I can live with it, but that's why I'm giving them like a B, B minus so far.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when the Switch first came out, and we talked about this some, but when the promo video or teaser video, whatever it was, came out, I was like, wow, that looks actually really cool. And then when it first came out, I thought, you know, that still looks really cool. And then I've played with my sister-in-laws and with some friends of ours a couple of times, very briefly. Wow, it's pretty cool. And for the last month or however long it's been out, I've been trying to convince myself that I don't play games anymore, which is accurate. That the last time I bought a console, I played it for a couple of months and then never touched it again, which is accurate. And thus, there is no reason to spend a whole bunch of money on a Switch, which I will probably use for a month and then never use again, which I presume to be accurate. That being said, just earlier tonight, I realized the super useful website iStockNow, which I knew as tracking Apple inventory for things like AirPods and whatnot, they actually track inventory for the Switch. And I am strongly considering making a trip to a neighboring town to pick up a Switch for myself tomorrow, in no small part because I know I'm going to have a couple of long plane rides in my future. And that seems like it'd be a really great way to spend some time on the plane. And so here it is. I am the antithesis of a typical console buyer, which is to say I don't buy consoles. I don't tend to play video games, and I feel like this console was made for me.
Yeah, maybe like it's the successful Vita. Oh, it's for a lot of people, yeah. That's how they're viewing it. Like, it is the best portable system I've ever had because the games on it are so amazing compared to, I mean, again, granted, they're being pulled up the average by having Breath of the Wild on it. But, you know, it's like, imagine if there was a portable system that got the best first-party titles from one of the best first-party developers in the world. That's the Switch, but I'm not interested in a portable, so that doesn't really help me much. But it does mean that the product is potentially more appealing than the Wii U, which had to sit in this weird middle ground. But yeah, I'm surprised that you are into it playing it in a portable, and that you, because you have pretty big hands as well, and I find the size of it is not conducive to my hands. Obviously, I have RSI issues on top of everything else, but it just feels a little bit awkward. And I've been playing with the Nintendo Pro Controller, and it's no GameCube controller, but it's okay. For a controller that doesn't have an octagonal surround around the analog sticks and thinks all the buttons are equally important, it's okay. Like, it's not great, but I like it better than the Wii U Pro Controller, which maybe isn't saying much, but it's something.
Great episode of Hypercritical, or greatest episode of Hypercritical?
It was an episode that exists.
Oh, wow. You're the worst. You are the worst. Which episode was that? Do you know offhand?
Yeah, I know. I don't know. Pinching the harmonica. It's a classic.
But you don't know an episode number?
In the 50s? In the 50s, I'm going to guess.
All right. I'll look it up.
You Google for Syracuse pinching the harmonica. It's going to be the number one hit, I guarantee you.
This sounds like a dangerous query. I don't know if I would.
Yeah.
Don't do an image search. Just regular text search and you'll find it.
49. You were very close.
And we caught you saying your own name twice in the last week.
Caught me? Is this a secret thing?
Yes.
I'll say it all day. Say it all night, all day.
Except that when you were having like a whole episode of Rectives about how no one pronounces your name right, you never said it.
I just don't want to encourage him. You can't give him what he wants. You know, he's incorrigible.
Yeah, that's it. Poor Merlin.
Mm.
Don't you give him your pity. He does not deserve it.
Well, you're bad cop today, aren't you? That's how this is playing, isn't it? Oh, goodness. All right. So, Marco, what do you think about the Switch? I mean, I know that Tiff has gotten herself one, or, well, maybe it was for you, but it's effectively hers. I don't remember what the backstory was. But, like, have you played it at all? Remind me what your scenario is with that.
I played the Wipeout clone for a few minutes, and that was fun.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, but that's it so far. I expect to play Mario Kart probably quite a bit.
Oh, amen, brother.
But that isn't out until the end of this month, I think. So, and also the Puyo Tetris, which I know from my Sega days as Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine Tetris. I will probably be enjoying that as well when that comes out, which I believe is also around Mario Kart time. And then whenever there's ever a Mario game for it, I will like that. If there's ever a virtual console that allows me to catch up a little bit on previous Mario games, as we previously discussed, I would like that. But otherwise, you know, yeah, I'm not that into it because I'm not that into games. I'm like you, but I've already bought it and I've realized that.
there is a Mario game coming, by the way, in case you're wondering. There totally is one.
It's a 3D one. Done. I don't like 3D.
Those are the real ones now.
No, they're
yeah,
not.
But it's a 3D. Everyone else is saying finally a real Mario game instead of one of these nostalgic throwback 2.5D things.
Yeah, no, that's what I want more 2.5D. To me, like that's what Mario games are. Like the 3D ones always felt like they were good games, but they didn't feel like Mario games to me. They felt like a different thing.
You're so stuck in the past.
No, it's just no.
I know you like your 2D games. You're playing through Sonic for crying out loud. Like you, I know you like 2D, but I love the 3D ones better, and I think they're
it's
great.
A different kind of game.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I was surprised by how. I mean, I talked about this on, I think it was on Rectifs, about how games that I loved in the 2D era made the transition to 3D, and I still love them, even though, like you said, it is a totally different game. Like, Zelda in 2D versus Zelda in 3D, very different. Mechanically, visually, like, so many things about it are different. And Mario, same thing. And yet, I still feel like there's a through line. I still feel like it's the same game, the same kind of feeling. The difference is that once they went 3D, I couldn't go back to the 2D ones anymore. It's like, well, why would I want to just jump up and down in 2D? I want to jump up and down in a 3D world.
To me, it's just like it's such different mechanics. Like, you know, certain games, like back in the like 8 and 16-bit era, racing games, like Mario Kart for Super Nintendo, played that game for so long. It was such a great game. But fundamentally, you were really navigating a 3D world. It just happened to be rendered in crude 2D that was trying to approximate it. But
and you used a lot of tapping because you didn't have analog sticks. So tapping was all about tapping the D-pad.
Right. But the point is, like, you know, translating Mario Kart from 2D to 3D just made it better. It didn't like fundamentally produce a different kind of game. It just, you know, you were already conceptually moving in 3D and it just made it better. But a platform game is an incredibly different playing game between 2D and 3D. Everything you can do is totally different. A lot of 2D stuff does not work in 3D and vice versa. So it is a totally different kind of game. And what made me so sad during the 32 and 64-bit console era was that all of my favorite 2D franchises were basically killed off for like 10 years while they made 3D versions. And that was fine, but that wasn't... It wasn't the same thing. I know I've had this rant before recently, so I'll stop it here. But 2D Mario and 3D Mario are different games, and for a while they didn't continue both, and I'm glad they, in recent years, have continued both, and I would love to play some of those new 2/2.5D Mario games. And by new, I just mean made after the 90s. So I know they're not new anymore for gamers, but for me, they would be new. And I would love to play them. But I wouldn't love to play them enough to go like buy a Wii U or something. So I'm hoping they come to virtual console and the Switch in some form.
So you said that they're totally different games, and I understand what you're saying in terms of, like, mechanically speaking, but the reason I feel like there's a through line is not so much, like, how do you control it and what is, you know, what is on the screen and, like, you know, how does the game work, but sort of the, I don't know, this, I don't say the spirit of the game, but, like, Mario is about running and jumping, that that you are exercising your athletic ability, this little character who's going to navigate the world that's full of hazard, it's full of things that you touch to kill you, pits that you fall into, enemies that hurt you when they touch you, and you are running and jumping. And I feel like Mario 3D captured, more than any game that had tried to do a similar thing before it, and it's why it's such an important game, captured the fun of running and jumping. What is fun about running around and jumping? That's, and yes, it's totally different. You're in 3D space. The whole rules of the world are different. Like, it's not like, you know, you live if you're traveling downward on the enemy, but if you're traveling upward, you die. Like, all this, all the mechanics of the old game, every rule system, every sort of how it controls in the air, how run works, you know, holding down B to run, like, all that stuff went away and was replaced with something entirely different. And yet I still feel like this is a game about the joy of running and jumping. Same thing with Zelda, which was about exploring a world. Big, scary, dangerous world that you don't understand, that, you know, that goes on for a long distance, that you have to slowly discover the mysteries of and collect items and become more powerful and eventually solve, solve a mystery and defeat an enemy and complete a story. And the change to 3D was like, you thought exploring was fun in 2D? It's even more fun when it's 3D with better graphics. And Breath of the Wild says, you thought it was fun exploring, like the idea of exploring. Well, this world is humongous, and your exploring is no longer constrained in the ways it used to be. All those games feel like, yes, Zelda is about exploration and conquest and mystery and, you know, defeating an enemy and story. And that's the through line I see, even though mechanically speaking, the game is varied a lot. So I think it really depends on what part of the game you were there for. If you were there for the mechanics and the mechanics change, well, it's like, well, this is a different game. But if you were there for the joy of running and jumping, and this new game in 3D even more thoroughly embodies the joy of running and jumping, then you will like the 3D games. So obviously, you know, which side of that I'm on, and that I think I'm at the point where I can say, I didn't even like the mechanics of the 2D ones. It's just that was the best incarnation of a game that made it, you know, that you got to experience the fun of running around and jumping. And then when they went to 3D, I just discarded the 2D. I'm like, well, I get more of that here. But if you like the 2D mechanics, the 3D one has nothing for you, and you're just waiting for the 2.5D games.
Did you guys play F-Zero on the Super Nintendo?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'm mostly looking at Marco.
Or yeah. On the N64, frame locked at 60 frames per second.
Yeah, it looked awesome at 60 frames. Like, there were basically no polygons, but it looked awesome.
Mm-hmm. That's the right trade-off for that game.
Yeah, I would say.
I love that game so darn much. My goodness, did I love that game.
I will say, though, like, one of the reasons why I've always liked Wipeout and Mario Kart is that racing games are fun, but racing games with weapons are a lot more fun. And that was one thing I always missed with F-Zero. Like, it always, like, I enjoyed going really fast and stuff, but I wanted to occasionally be able to fire a missile at Casey, and I couldn't do that.
Oh, and speaking of games, like, so we were playing, I'm still playing Breath of the Wild, obviously, and I got the chance to try out the thing that I was suggesting Marco try out, but that he said he tried and didn't like, which is Breath of the Wild as essentially a party game. We had some company over, and we had, like, you know, a couple of adults and their kids, and all of us just sitting in the same room playing Breath of the Wild, which is a single player game, together as a party game, because especially if you have someone who's you have the person who's ostensibly controlling the game, but then you have an entire room full of people who have opinions about what should be done next or what you should try, or just, you know, laughing at the results of the most recent experiment. Because even just playing Breath of the Wild single player is a constant series of distractions. Just try progressing the story quest. You can't do it because it's like, oh, what's that over there? Oh, what's this? Oh, I want to do this. And you'll find yourself 20 degrees removed from what you thought you were doing, and you're having fun the whole time. And if you have a room full of people who are also engaged with that, even though none of them are actually playing, telling you, spotting something out of the corner of their eye that you didn't see, or getting excited about something that happened, or giving you a suggestion about something to try, it worked very well. Maybe it wouldn't work well as you get deep into the game and people start to suss out what the mechanics are, but for a room full of people, half of which had never even seen Breath of the Wild. It was hilarious and fun, and the most fun I've had, quote unquote, playing a video game in a large group, even though, again, one person had the controller and it was not me, in a long time. And that's what I was suggesting Marco do with when Tiff is playing, but apparently he's still just bored and falls asleep, and Adam is her co-pilot.
Well, to be honest, Marco's about to fall asleep anyway.
That's true, for different reasons.
This was before he went to Ireland. He was still falling asleep on the couch. He's an old man. He's got a beard now. He just, like, put him on the couch, and 3 seconds later, his eyes are closed, and he's snoring. And then you wake him up, he says, I was just resting my eyes.
Thanks to our three sponsors this week, Betterment, Jamf, and MailRoute, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
Let's talk about something really important. Let's talk about WWDC lunches in indescribable detail. So this came up a couple of shows ago. I forget exactly how, but I guess it was when we were talking about the change from Moscone to wherever we are in San Jose. And one of us, might have been me, brought up the WWDC lunches. And I think the two of you kind of immediately poo-pooed them, and I said, oh, really, they're not that bad. And I think John made a joke about, oh, we should talk about that in great detail another time, and it turns out John wasn't entirely joking. And a better man would not bring this up and say it's a stupid idea, but I am not that man, and I'm anxious to talk about WWDC lunches in great detail. So
this is amazing.
I have scoured the internet.
So just to be clear, we are talking about the conference center box lunches for an event that is no longer happening in that conference center and will no longer have this particular box lunch series. And also, the event itself is not happening for another almost 2 months from now. And this is what we're talking about right now. Oh, I love you guys so much.
Two shows worth of Mac Pro stuff made Casey willing to talk about literally anything else.
Literally anything. Or since I've just finished Parks and Rec, I will talk about literally anything right now other than the Mac Pro. Anyway, so John, why don't you tell us about WWDC box launches?
Yeah, so this came up in the talking about the conference and the things that are good and bad about it. Maybe we were talking about Ottawa and stuff like that. And here's the thing about WWDC. It's an expensive conference. It's expensive to put on, I'm sure. It's in an expensive city. Things in conference centers, if you've never put on a conference yourself or talked to anybody who has, are absurdly expensive, much more expensive than you think they are, because there's a lot of other costs built into them. Apple usually has, I think, in general, pretty good food and drink options, especially considering the scale. I mean, granted, it's not like 50,000 people like a really giant convention, but 5,000 people is nothing to sneeze at. If you're trying to give snacks and drinks to 5,000 people, it's really easy to cheap out. And Apple, in general, tries to do better. They have, like, donuts and danishes, which are, you know, reasonable quality donuts and danishes. Some of them I actually like. Like Marco mentioned, is usually one that's really good. I think a lot of them are actually really good. I have no idea how the coffee is because I don't drink it.
The bagels are garbage.
Well, you know, San Francisco. Come on.
Obviously.
You're not going to get bagels on the West Coast. For the drinks, when they had Ottawa is a fairly expensive, I think, high-quality beverage. It's not like they're putting out RC Cola for everybody, right? Apologies to the RC fans. So I think, as far as conference goes, like, they're certainly not really the top of the heap. Maybe they're not even above average for these things I just listed, but they're about average. I've definitely been to conferences that have much better food, but also much, much worse. So I think they're doing okay for all those things. By the way, all those things, and also, like, fresh fruit and other stuff that you get out in the hallways, pretty good. Also, probably astronomically expensive if you were to add up, like, how much does this one muffin I picked up cost Apple? You know, oh, great, $27 for this muffin? Yum, yum, yum. Doesn't make it taste any better, but just to get the scale of the cost here.
Oh, my God.
Much more expensive than you think. But then we come to the lunches. And the lunches are not at any different scale than anything else, because when they put out, like, those snack foods and the things, and, like, when you're lining up to get into Presidio for the keynote, Every one of those 5,000 people or however many people are there take something from there. Like, the food goes. It's not as if it's, you know, the lunch is 10 times bigger than the snacks. They put out enough snacks and enough drinks for all the people who are in the conference if they wanted them, right? And so lunch is the same deal. A lot of people go out to lunch, so it's, you know, the same kind of ratio. I'm not sure what happens for the lunch food, because it's the same problem. How do you feed a reasonable quality product to a large group of people, right? So you have all the same problems of scale and, you know, packaged food versus freshly made, you know, or all the same problems. And yet somehow, for lunch in particular, they blow it. They are well below average, even below Apple's own average. For example, if you have ever been to an Apple Tech Talk, I think the food at the Tech Talks is better than this lunch food. Maybe because it's not, I think even the lunches are, they have similar little box lunches. So anyway, this is what the lunch is like. You line up with everybody else and you go across a big series of tables. They do a good job with traffic flow. Like, you know, the lines move, it's massively distributed. It's a parallel architecture, kind of like Altavec for the old folks, you know, single instruction, multiple developer. All right. And there's lots of tables with maybe three choices. You got the chicken, the beef, and the vegetarian option. And there's a bunch of plastic, clear plastic boxes that have three areas in them. There's the main area where they're going to put the main part of your lunch. There's one little corner of the thing that is kind of like a desserty thing. And then there's like a side dish thing. And somehow they manage to find the most inappropriate things to put inside this vessel. Their most common failure mode is to pick something that needs to be crispy or dry in some way, and to put it inside this container that traps moisture, so that whatever your sandwich or piece of bread or whatever thing is sitting in is next to some wet side dish or something that seeps into the bread. And there's nothing worse than picking up a sandwich that has been sitting there in liquid for a long period of time before you got to it. Same thing with any kind of bread that requires freshness or staleness or whatever to you know, not being stale to be good, that is the crux of making this dish good, and you get it with some kind of styrofoam like bread substance on it, or putting spreads on, like putting like mustard or mayonnaise or other kind of wet spreads on the bread, but putting them directly against the bread instead of in between the layers so they soak into the bread. And for the side dishes, there's not much you can do with side dishes because it's room temperature, it's not hot, but they will very often put side dishes that should be hot in a room temperature container, which is the wrong thing to be putting there. And the desserts, like, that's such an easy win. Just give us a damn chocolate chip cookie. Put a piece of chocolate cake in there. Like, it's not hard. Like, these things keep, you know, you can buy prepackaged ones. Put two Chips Ahoy in. Like, you would kill, at a certain point, you would kill for a Chips Ahoy. And instead, these are like these handmade, like, supposed to be sugary sweet confections that are, it tastes like, you know, tastes like ashes in your mouth. Like, they're just terrible little squares of potentially sweet thing. Again, also alternately stale and soggy. And there's no reason for this. There's no reason to try to make an artisanal, perfect, beautiful, complicated, sophisticated thing. You got to put in foods that taste good and will keep. And that's what they do on the outside. Like, donuts keep. Danishes keep, right? A banana keeps. Oddball in the container keeps. But when it comes to lunch, I feel like they're trying to make like these beautifully prepared chef dishes and then shoving them into plastic and let them just stew there. And it is a terrible, terrible experience. And I say this as someone who has had probably more box lunches on average than most attendees who WWDC. Because I get the box lunch pretty much every day because I don't want to go out and have to come back. I just want to run down there quickly, get my lunch, eat it, and then go get in line for the next thing. So I eat all these things, but sometimes even I, with, you know, in a hurry to be utilitarian, just can't make it through the food. And sometimes you just take one forkful of that side dish and you're like, all right, that's it, I'm done. And you eat half of the soggy sandwich, or you just leave the bottom half of the sandwich down there and you just eat the top half. And I wish I could remember, I should have recorded these in film. Sometimes they don't do sandwiches, sometimes it's other kind of lunch things. And sometimes it's just literally inedible. It's like, there's no food to be had here. This was, I don't know what this is even supposed to be.
Here be dragons.
It tastes terrible. It looks terrible. It has to be eaten with a fork out of this little container. And I feel like I'm on like a spaceship eating one of those, you know, space food that comes out of a tube or something. So,
oh my God.
This topic was so worth it.
Anyway.
The funny thing is, I actually don't think they're that bad. Like, nothing you said is wrong. I am not disagreeing with anything you said. I just think I'm less bothered by it. Generally speaking, I find the sandwiches to be perfectly acceptable. They are not great. I'm even hard-pressed to say they're good. They're just fine. I don't typically run into the bread sogginess problem, but again, I agree with what you said, that they definitely pair things that will create a bread sogginess vortex, so you are not wrong.
And also, like, the quality of the ingredients between the bread, like, whatever they put there, whether it's a cold cut or a piece of chicken or some arugula or lettuce, it's always, like, the worst form of that. So if it's chicken, the chicken is just dry as chalk. If it is lettuce, lettuce is completely wilted. You know, if it's ham, the ham tastes like it's entirely made of filler and like a pig walked by it once.
Oh my god. I can't continue. I'm dead.
I mean, I'm with you, Casey. Like, I don't actually, like, you know, I've also eaten a lot of these, not as many as John has, because I will usually try to escape the conference center for lunch at least a couple of the days. But I've eaten a good number of them, and it, to me, they're always not great, but they're always better than I expect them to be. You know, because I look at them and I have very low expectations, because they are these, yep, like, you know, mass produced, clearly well ahead of time, because usually they're not room temperature. Usually they're cold, like the whole box is cold. So they were usually, you know, I assume they're sitting in a fridge for a few hours between preparation
or a couple weeks, you know,
or
whatever.
Manufacturing, I guess. But anyway, they're always, to me, like, about the quality of, like, to like modern day airplane food on a decent airline. So it's like, it's not as bad as you expect, and actually not that bad. And it mostly tastes like nothing, but you don't really care. If it has any flavor at all, the flavor is from like the like salad dressing that they use to moisten the sandwich and provide some flavor. Like, that's really where all the flavor comes from. So it just tastes like some cold lettuce and chicken with a little bit of salad dressing on it. And that's fine. And
I think the comparison to airplane food is good, because I get that same sense from airplane food in that it tastes like it's dead. It tastes like it's from, I was going to reference a Stephen King story that neither of you have even heard of and no one who's listening has read. But anyway, it tastes like all of the sort of life has been sucked out of it. And an airplane, it's a lot about like you being in, you know, different cabin pressure and recycled air and in a small space and all the other things that make planes weird, right? But this is on the ground where it looks like a sandwich, but when you bite it, all you can feel is the texture, and there's like literally no taste, or if there is taste, it's a bad taste. And that's what, you know, and the dressing they put on it to try to be fancy that has made the bread all soggy and gross, and the bread already wasn't very good. Like, all you get is like the feeling of eating foam rubber and then a momentary tang of the terrible mustard spread or vinegar thing that they put on it. And it's a lot like being on the airplane, because you buy your $20 sandwich and it's like you realize the sandwich has become a homogenous solid, that it is no longer a bunch of individual ingredients, and you bite into it, and again, all you experience is the varying textures of the things, but nothing has any taste.
I mean, but I've never had as negative a reaction as you have, yep, to these. Like, I've you know, usually when I'm eating them, I'm paying attention to what I'm eating for at most one bite, but I'm also like usually like thinking about what I just saw in sessions, or I'm talking to you guys or other people who are around or whatever else, and so like I'm not. Like, before I know it, I have consumed the mass that's in this plastic container, and I have not given a second thought to it. And I'm drinking some kind, yep, of sugary, disgusting, like, iced tea thing or something, and it's fine.
Oh, that terrible iced tea. What is it? Nest tea? I know some people like that, but
it's Lipton canned iced tea, which is full of sugar.
Yeah, why can't they serve us a proper, like, carbonated beverage? Why is that so hard? Now, yeah. I shouldn't be that grumpy.
No, they have other carbonated beverages. I just don't take them because
really bad lemonade is one of their choices, yeah, and really bad, yep, iced tea is their other choice.
That's correct.
Oh, they don't have, like, sodas in there?
Not during lunch. That's the thing. They'll put them out at snack time, but they won't do it at, God, I sound like a 4-year-old. They'll put it out at snack time.
They put out the mats for the naps. That's when they bring it out.
Yeah, right. But no, there's no soda during launch, which drives me batty because you're exactly right. Like the real issue here is that it's crappy lemonade, or, well, I don't drink iced tea, but my understanding is, like you guys said, it's crappy iced tea.
I mean, to be fair, like I'm not even sure I would call that iced tea. Like it's just a ton of sugar.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the tea flavor is in it. I mean, it's just like terribly sickly sweet sugary liquid.
Yeah, it tastes very little like actual iced tea. It tastes a lot more like, and like I always grab it thinking like, I don't want all the sugar of soda. Let me grab this iced tea, and of course it has just as much, if not more, sugar as most soda. And it's every time just like, ugh, it's so sweet. But no, I mean, I just don't. I've never found them that offensive. And I wonder, John, are you just making bad choices? So like normally when you approach the rows of tables that have all these on them, you're usually given about three options, and it'll usually be something along the lines of like chicken, roast beef, and vegetarian. Given that choice, John, which do you pick? Because I'll tell you what, like I would never pick roast beef. I would usually in that case pick the chicken option.
Well, the only one I could say I pretty much never pick is vegetarian. I've picked vegetarian maybe twice out of, like, you know, the 30 days I've been at WWDC so far in my life. And it has been a terrible mistake every time because I have not liked them, right? So for the other choices, I feel like I've rotated pretty well because I'm desperately in search of something I can find edible. So it's not like I'm saying if there's chicken and beef, always pick beef. Like, I'm about 50-50 on the choices, and I'm not going with what I think I would like better if both were made well. I'm entirely going on, like, eyeballing them and saying, does that look like it's going to be... Like, for example, like, I've learned it's best for me to avoid wraps. So if I have a choice between anything in a wrap and something not in a wrap, it's best to avoid wraps because the wraps really emphasize the homogeneous solid thing. Like, whatever the constituent ingredients were, they wrap it all up, put it together, make it all soggy, put it in the fridge, and it just becomes this like giant hunk of cookie dough, only it doesn't taste like cookies. And doesn't matter what they put in it. And so because there'll be like vegetables in there, terrible meat will be mixed into the thing, some kind of liquid or mayo, and then the wrapping on the outside, all soggy and cold, and all completely tasteless. So in general, I avoid wraps, and I will prefer avoiding the wraps over the particular thing in them. I have learned that chicken is super dangerous if it's thick because it always ends up being very, very dry. But other than that, I'm willing to give almost anything a try. I'm willing to believe that this one is going to be the one that is not completely vile. And most of the time, I can get through it because, again, you're sitting there talking to people or whatever. But I do find myself briefly distracted while sitting there eating my thing to go, oh, this is real. This is terrible. I can't even believe this. Then you just continue going your way. Sometimes I just can't get through it. Side dishes have the lowest percentage for me. It's like, it's just a write-off. I don't pick based on the side dishes. I assume all the side dishes will be terrible.
That is pretty accurate, to be honest. See, that's the thing is, to me, the sandwich to me is usually okay. I agree that the meat is maybe ham adjacent rather than ham. The bread may be a little wetter than you want, but it's edible. It's usually fine. But in the dessert, oftentimes I don't care for the particular flavor of the dessert because, as an example, I don't, and this may not even be accurate, but I don't like cranberries. So maybe it's like a cranberry-based dessert. And so that's a Casey problem, not a dessert problem. But the side dish tends to be pretty esoteric in my personal opinion. And I agree with you, probably 4 times out of 5 just gets written off.
The one thing with the side dish to me is that, so it is also, you know, the same general formula of like, we'll take some bland ingredients and we will apply some kind of salad dressing to them to generate flavor. The main problem I have with the side dish is I almost always actually enjoy them, but they always taste completely unexpected from how I thought they should taste based on how they looked. Because like whatever pairings they make between like the salad dressing or whatever is giving them the flavor and the ingredients in them, like it looks nothing like it tastes. And again, I usually end up, it's usually good enough. I usually like it, but I'm always shocked by what is in my mouth after I've seen it.
I also have, I think one of the things that makes me predisposed to not like most of these things is,
you're a super tasty.
Especially for things like side dishes. Like I said, very often they will put things in side dishes that I expect to be served not cold or not at room temperature. So any rice-based side dish. I know plenty of, you know, people like rice at room temperature, or there are rice dishes that are, you know, room temperature. But when I see a rice-based side dish, I don't expect it to be cold. I don't want to eat cold rice, period, no matter what is in it. And you know, same thing for things like potato salad can be cold, which is fine, but depending on what, if they make a side dish that looks like it's like roast potatoes, I don't want room temperature roast potatoes. Who wants room temperature roast? But never mind that the potatoes were probably not good the second they came out of the oven. But certainly after sitting in that little container, stewing in that little steamy, you know, Dagobah pit inside there, you do not want those roast potatoes. And Marco's totally right about the they taste weirder than you think, because they're not, you can't categorize them. That's why very often the most pertinent question at any WWC lunch table is, what is the side dish? Like, you can't categorize. You can't say, it's green beans, it's potato salad, it's corn. It's like sometimes it's a puzzle just to say, forget about giving a name to this thing. Let's just take for granted this has no name. Can you identify the constituent ingredients? What? There's a green thing, there's a white thing, and there's a yellow thing. Everyone, what do you think the yellow thing is? Is it squash? Is it potato? Is it onion? And you have to put it in your mouth, and you're like, I'm still not sure. Yeah, because it's covered in some weird liquid or something. I seem to recall one that was like,
oh my goodness,
chopped up celery and then like cubes of cucumber and like onions with like a green sprinkly stuff on it and then like a cream-based dressing. It's like, that's, you're just making stuff up. Like, it's not, that's not anything. I don't know what that's supposed to be. I never know what they're going to taste like. I can't predict which ones I'm going to even be able to tolerate, but it's usually a lot of them is one forkful, and then it's like, never mind. That's why you save snacks. By the way, pro tip, that's why in the morning when they have the good danishes and stuff, find a way to successfully save those in your backpack without them destroying all your stuff, like a piece of Tupperware or something.
You put the snacks in your purse.
I don't, but I should. What I do is I save bananas because they are, I don't have a container like that, but I would love to be able to save donuts or danishes because those are good, right? Instead, what I end up saving are bananas because they come with their own wrapper and you can put them in your backpack and in general. Just don't forget they're in there. If you take a banana and save it so you have desperation food at lunch, do not forget that banana is in there, because if you leave it for a few days at the bottom of your backpack that you're sliding your MacBook in and out of, it's a bad scene.
Oh my God.
Never happened to me, but I'm very conscious of it.
You know, I'm a little sad that, I wasn't able to go to this place last year because it had shut down, I think, in 2015. But there, what was the name of that? Witchcraft, I think it was.
Witchcraft, yeah. There was the good thing is it's a chain. You can get them all over the place, but just not there anymore.
Yeah, there was a really good Witchcraft that was right around the corner that I liked. I would typically go and meet like a buddy from Apple or someone else that was local at Witchcraft one of the days during lunch. There's also a burger place that I've been to a couple times. God, I'm drawing a blank the name of it. There's a couple of them that are close to Moscone. Again, they're obviously a chain, and so I'm sure they exist other places too. But there's some sort of burger place, Super Duper, that is right down the road from Moscone. That's very good as well.
I always think of Dave Nanning when I see it. I'm like, hey, it's that backup burger.
Backup burger?
Super Duper, the backup program.
Oh, I get it. I'm an idiot. I get it.
I think I took a picture of that sign to send him last time I was there.
So I'm kind of bummed that I may not have the chance to eat at any of those places. And like I said, Witchcraft had already shut down, which I don't get because it was so tasty. But anyway, I typically eat the lunches. I think I'm in the same boat as Marco in that I do go out from time to time, but I do generally eat the lunches probably 3 days out of five, and I don't find myself deeply offended by them. I would not say they're good. I would not say they're great, but I would not necessarily say they're actively bad. They just kind of exist. What did they say about the Mac Mini? Like it's a product in our lineup. This is a lunch that is in Moscone.
I'm with you, Casey. I was very happy with that. Like I would say very happy. I was consistently satisfied by them. Like, and that was one thing they had. And this is what you need if you're going to be in the business of mass lunch. What you need is consistency and like minimum acceptability. And I think they delivered that. Like they were never great, but I'd never had one where I was just like, oh, this is disgusting. I can't eat this. Like it was always fine. Often weird, but always fine.
I didn't know that you both had such a high opinion of this because...
Well, it's not that we have a high opinion.
If we're ever in WWC together again, and if we ever have lunches of this caliber again, I don't need to interrogate you in real time to say, that thing that you're eating, let us discuss it in detail right now, because my opinion of it is that... Like, I think they are pretty consistent. Like, they were consistently below average for me. Like... There were no highlights. I can think of that one time they had the really good lunch. I can't think of that at all. They were always below average, and it was just a question of how low. Like none of them gave me food poisoning, so I'm not going to say they're like, you know, super terrible.
Well, that's good. But yeah,
that's a high bar.
Well, I'm pretty sure we found our live venue for our next.
I was going to say, like, if ever there was a purpose for Periscope, it's that moment when we're all together and we're discussing how bad the WWDC launches are.
We're trying to guess what the side dish is.
Right? Yeah. Exactly.
So true. It's a new spinoff podcast. Guess the side dish. What is this?
Right, like everyone's talking, like Underscore's telling us like about all the limitations of all the new APIs that he has already found, and we're all trying to figure out what the heck this side dish is that we're eating.
So true.
And then if we ever figure it out and identify the ingredients, then we have to come up with a name for it.
Yeah, this is actually this has legs. We should run with this. But you know, in true San Franciscan style, they just serve the minimum viable lunch, and that's what you get.